Welcome to American Diplomat, our stories behind the news. I'm Pete Romero, and with me in the hot seat is...
Oh, well, Laura Bennett.
Oh, well.
Hot seat, hardly.
Well,
okay.
Okay. So it's a term of reference. Anyway, we have today one Ambassador Tom Shannon. And Tom Shannon and I were colleagues for a long, long time in the Career Foreign Service of State. Tom enjoyed a 35-year career in the Foreign Service, occupying positions as Assistant Secretary of State, U.S. Ambassador to Brazil, Counselor for the Department of State, Deputy Secretary, Undersecretary for Political Affairs. And if I'm not mistaken, he had a brief stint of, I think it was 17 days as Acting Secretary of State between the outgoing Trump administration and the incoming Biden administration.
12,
okay, I stand corrected. But if there's anyone who kind of can untangle a little bit what we're going to see in the first 90 days of a Trump administration, it is Tom Shannon.
American Diplomat is a project of Arizona State University's Leadership, Diplomacy, and National Security Lab, led by senior former diplomatic and national security professionals and providing character-driven leadership, diplomacy, and national security education and training. Thank you also to the American Academy of Diplomacy with support from the American Foreign Service Association, the professional association of the U.S. Foreign Service, and home to the award-winning publication, The Foreign Service Journal. Visit them online at www.afsa.org. And thank you to the generous support of the Carnegie Corporation of New York. We're talking.
Thank you for coming, Tom. Thank you for coming back. How are you doing?
Well, thank you for having me here on the show. I'm very happy to have the chance to talk with both of you.
Well, Tom, let me get started here with just a general chapeau of what might constitute a strategy behind the Trump administration. And that is, there's a certain feeling that that the Trump administration won't be isolationist to the extent that people have painted it beforehand, and that some of his people are describing what they will do overseas as more focused on restraint, that meaning not getting involved in kinds of typical kinds of support to governments that we have done over the last, well, over the last 80 years, in many cases, since the Cold War. And one of the ingredients of all of that is, you know, what Trump talks about all the time, and that is his unpredictability as an asset. How do you think that will play? In other words, people have described it as transactional and, you know, what are you going to do for me now and what I'll do for you and all of this. But there is a certain element of unpredictability. How does that play internationally, Tom?
It's a great question, Pete, and thank you for beginning with this, because I think it allows us to have a conversation about what President Trump hopes to accomplish broadly in terms of foreign policy. If you think back to his first term, the initial weeks were defined by chaos, with the spontaneous combustion of his national security advisor, the collapse effectively of the interagency for a period of time until H.R. McMaster was brought in to clean things up. And then, of course, the fact that he was unfamiliar with most of his national security cabinet members, had not known them personally, had not worked with them personally, and he was brand new to the presidency. And that meant that in the beginning months, there was a free-form nature to what was being done, and one that was very surprising and unsettling for many of our partners and allies, and disturbing for our adversaries, because they were trying to understand what direction the administration would be going in and to what extent there was any predictability at all. Now, there's a lot to be said for predictability in foreign affairs, as you know well, because it allows people to calculate, and more importantly, it allows people not to miscalculate or not to make a mistake. I think what we're going to see at the beginning of this administration is a much more tightly run operation. We have a president who already has 4 years of experience behind him. He has a coterie of people around him who also have considerable experience. And he's going to be reaching out and bringing into his cabinet people that he has been conversing with in one fashion or another over these past several years. And so I think we're going to see a fairly well-defined agenda that will be predictable up to a point. But one of the defining personality characteristics of the president is his idiosyncrasy, his ability to understand things differently and approach them differently, and to demand that people around him respond to that different understanding. And so it will be unpredictability, but it will be unpredictability of a different kind than in the first administration. It will be one in which he is attempting to lay out a foreign affairs policy and approach, which will be unusual, if not unique. And you mentioned it in terms of restraint. Other presidents have spoken about this. Other presidents have spoken about the United States stepping back from security commitments, market access commitments in the aftermath of the Cold War and the construction of a global economy. President Trump will actually do it.
So, in the past, many of us described his changing policies as transactional in nature. Would you say that that is still the case, or are they more directed by longer-term goals in this instance?
No, I think they are transactional. I do think there are some longer term goals. I mean, first and foremost is the security of the homeland. And that's not just military security, it's also border security. But I think that he ultimately is not driven by ideology. He's driven by success and by the ability to show that his policies are enhancing the well-being and the prosperity of the American people.
So, well, that does bring us to the topic of the border. So let's talk about that. There is $1 million of bilateral business every minute crossing the border, 1.8 billion a day. So when you talk about securing the border, we've heard the term securing the border, we've heard the term close the border. What does this look like going forward in your view?
Listen, for him, this is a political symbol that he uses to highlight the failure of previous governments, and not just democratic governments, but previous governments in defining a approach to migration and approach to our southwest border that ensures a degree of order in the movement across that frontier. Regrettably, from my point of view, his way of articulating it doesn't take into account what you just noted, which is that this is the most crossed border in the world, the most peaceful border in the world, and the richest border in the world, and that the economies of not just our southern neighbor, Mexico, but also our northern neighbor, Canada, the economies of these countries are so marbled into the U.S. economy that any effort to fundamentally block legal movement of peoples and legal movement of goods and services is going to have really dramatic impact on the economies of all of our northern and southern border states.
Well, the thing about the border is that it is a membrane, and the challenge is always to bring in the good and to forestall the bad. And I think that one of the things that both candidates agreed upon was better border enforcement. There's no question. And so that's going to happen. But as it relates to kind of an offshoot of all of this, and that is the deportations, Tom. You can't close the border, but he has committed himself to what he has called massive deportations. Is that realistic?
It will be very difficult to accomplish if what he's talking about is rounding up 11 to 12 million people, holding them in camps, and then deporting them to all their countries of origin. And it will be difficult because, first of all, how do you find these people? Secondly, how do you detain them? Under what authorities? Third, how do you hold them? Under what circumstances and for how long? And then fourth, and most importantly, how do you convince anybody to take them back?
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. We're talking about millions. What is it? 7-8 million Venezuelans alone?
Yeah. No, I mean, the challenge here, of course, is always going to be the receiving country. Even if you successfully solve the issue of arrest, detention, you need a partner who takes back people. And if you are asking Central American countries to take back millions of people who will then not be providing remittances back into the economies of these countries, you're going to be generating a level of confusion and conflict in these countries that will be significant. And so it's not that we should not have an orderly border process. It's not that we should not insist on people being in the United States legally. It's having built over the years migration processes around informality and illegality that respond more to the demands of the American economy than they do to the demands of our own laws. We're in a position right now where we can't do this by ourselves. If President Trump and the team around him decide that this is the path forward, it has to be done with the participation of all the receiving countries.
It has to be, yeah, because that's in the final analysis, that's part of the solution. You can't keep people in camps indefinitely because they're illegal in your country. And, of course, Mexico is going to play a big role in all of this.
So I have a question about these receiving countries. Trump does not come across in a super friendly, cooperative way to anybody outside of the United States, as far as I'm aware. And so how does he get them to take them back? It's not going to be sort of like, as you say, there's no economic interest, and there are security reasons probably not to take them back. How does he do it?
Well, he'll do it the way he did it the first time when he began negotiating the safe third country agreements with Central American countries, with the hope of holding asylum applicants away from the U.S. border and away from the United States, which is he'll use trading relationships. And he'll use that as a point of pressure to win the support of the government.
I'm glad you raised that, Tom, because that's exactly what first of all, I think that they will go after felons and people who are threats in the communities that they live in, illegal immigrants. But I also think, or undocumented immigrants, but I also think that they will start to go after others eventually, but they'll focus on the felons first. But you touched on the issue of tariffs, and he's talked about a 20% tariff on all imported goods across the board, raising it up to 60% for China, I think it is. But getting back to how we started this, and that is the transactional nature of it. You just put your finger on something I think very important. He would largely cut separate deals, particularly as it relates to tariffs, to countries that might be willing to cooperate on the immigration issue or on the deportation issue.
Correct. No, that is the pressure point. But you know, there's he's going to face an immediate political challenge if they begin this larger mass deportation effort. And you mentioned it earlier, it's Venezuelans. If he were to decide, you know, to begin to arrest and deport Venezuelans, in order to deport them to Venezuela, he needs the cooperation of the Venezuelan government or regime, you choose the phrase. Otherwise, he would have to deport them to a third country.
Right. And already the countries in the region have been inundated by fleeing Venezuelans who are fleeing the total chaos and breakdown of their society. But getting back to the tariffs as a concept, how does that play out, Tom? Is he likely to just throw out a 20% tariff on all imported goods across the board as a starting point?
I think he's going to do what he said he was going to do. I think he intends to use tariffs as a way of restructuring U.S. trading relationships and making it very clear that access to the U.S. market requires one to come hat in hand, that it's not something built around global trading agreements or regional trading agreements. And in this sense, what he would be doing in many ways is completing the teardown of global trading systems and structures that has been happening over time because of conflict with Russia, Iran, and others, and the use of sanctions to begin to limit the capacity of global markets to move goods and services freely.
What happens when this hurts us? Because it will initially, and maybe even in the long term, maybe more than it hurts some of our trading partners, such as China.
Well, this is the political problem that he and his cabinet members are going to have to deal with. It's worth noting that in the first administration, he had every intention of leaving the North American Free Trade Agreement. And in fact, at one moment, his then advisor or counselor, Steve Bannon, went into the Oval Office and presented him a draft executive order announcing that the United States was leaving NAFTA. At the time, the chief of staff, Rince Priebus, got on the phone and called the Secretary of State, the Secretary of Commerce, the Secretary of Agriculture, and said, come to the Oval Office immediately. And all three of them showed up, and there was a very vociferous argument in the Oval Office about the value of trade, with the Secretary of Agriculture insisting that some of the president's most ardent supporters were going to be seriously harmed if the United States walked out of NAFTA.
These were Midwest farmers.
Correct. But also everybody along the Southwest border, everybody in Texas, everybody in Arizona, you name it. And the president, in frustration, kind of threw the draft executive order at them and said, okay, well, then you guys fix this agreement. And of course they did. And along with the help of the Canadians and the Mexicans, they constructed the U.S.-Canada-Mexico Agreement, which was a kind of remarkable modernization of NAFTA and a real bipartisan success. And one could imagine something similar happening with the tariffs, in the sense that the president's prepared to move forward to meet a campaign promise, but his cabinet members are telling him, you have to approach this more carefully. And so there is a space there for fixing things, and to ensuring that things aren't done in a way that are dramatically harmful. But the initial impulse will be to do it.
Well, that's really interesting. So he creates these absolutist positions, but because he lives in reality, just like everyone else, they don't turn out to be ultimately, as he states initially. That's a useful piece of insight.
It is. And what you see unfolding here in terms of a decision-making process, and correct me if I'm wrong here, Tom, is that you have an absolutist, or as Laura said, or a maximalist position taken by the President of the United States, whether it be rhetorically or through diplomatic channels. Then you have his advisors and department heads going out and negotiating whatever that issue is, whether it be tariffs or immigration, you know, whatever it might be, and basically arguing from a position of extremes that we need to satisfy what the president's red lines are, and starting negotiations from a much more extreme, if you will, position as opposed to a more moderate position.
Should we move on to talk about the elephant in the living room, the Ukraine war? Trump wants to show strength to Putin, and so this is a complicated thing. Trump has been accused of being an ally of Putin, and there's talk about how he will end this war, and perhaps he will open with an idea that Putin should take back some of the territories that he either has lost in Russia or some of the territories that he wants in Ukraine, but that would not be a maximalist type of solution for Putin. And Putin might prefer to not incrementalize his victory. What do you think will happen there in terms of negotiations and U.S. support? Oh, and then there's also talk about trying to make the rest of the United States allies pay us back for the expenditures we have already incurred in support of Ukraine. What do you make of this mess?
I would say several things. First of all, for the president-elect and the people who have supported him, their comments on Ukraine are meant, I believe, to send a very clear message to the American people that President Trump is not going to be a war president, number one, and that he is not going to commit the United States to never-ending security relationships, where we leave the security of the United States and our kind of financial commitments open-ended, depending on either the aggressiveness of the Russians or the determination of the Ukrainians. So I think he will early on make it very clear that there's a significant time limit to our ability to continue to support Ukraine. Now, there's going to be real disagreement with over that within the Republican Party itself and within the Congress, because there are many people who believe that Russia is more than an adversary, that it's a determined enemy, and that the safety and well-being of Central Europe is crucial to the security of the United States. That still has to be worked out. But I do not believe that President Trump will have a whole lot of patience for allowing this to drag on much longer.
Right. Well, I think that a solution that might be staring us in the face on this is that essentially the Russians are able to negotiate the Ukrainians out of Kursk, which was always a bargaining chip anyway. It had no real military significance. And they keep basically what they have. And in exchange, Ukraine gets to be a NATO member. I think that would probably be easier for Ukraine to stomach than it would be for Putin. But then again, Trump has this special relationship with Putin. Do you think that there might be a solution along those lines?
There might be, but I would make two comments on them. First, that kind of solution, from the point of view of the Russians, would be like a truce. It would not stop them from pursuing in the future their larger objective, which is a complete neutralization of Ukraine as a member of a Western alliance. And so we would have to assume that while the fighting might stop in the short term, it would start again, similar to the wars that Russia fought with Finland in the 1930s. But the point of view of the Ukrainians will be more important, because the Ukrainians, I think, have made very clear that they have no intention of submitting to the Russians. And I think that will continue. And I think the kind of deal that you've laid out, while it might be the basis for an armistice or a truce of some kind, I think would be very difficult for the current Ukrainian government and the Ukrainian people to accept, unless it were evident that they had no further hope. And that, of course, will depend not just on the United States, but on our NATO allies and the extent to which the European powers, especially the UK, France, and Germany, and then the frontline states, believe that Russia has ambitions that are larger than Ukraine, in which case they're going to be very careful. So this is an issue of extraordinary complexity, and it is not something in which a solution can be imposed. It has to be negotiated, and it requires time. And unfortunately, the president-elect has put himself in a position in which he has argued or asserted that he's going to solve this tout suite.
But at the end of the day, Tom, and at the risk of making a silk purse out of a sow's ear here, okay, so let me put that on the table first. My feeling, my gut feeling about our foreign policy and the conduct of the same over the last several years has been that it's been more muscle memory than it has been thoughtful. And that our support for different regimes and organizations has been more than automatic. It's been expected. Okay. And these institutions have served us exceedingly well. Whether you're talking about NATO or the World Bank or the IMF or all of the Bretton Woods institutions, it has given us stability and prosperity at a level that humankind has never, ever known. And yet, our foreign policy and what's happening with the world on the political side just seems to be just more and worse of the same. And so getting back to the silk purse out of a sow's ear, maybe it's not a bad thing to question some of these institutions, to question the alliances, and to see what happens under kind of a real-world stress test when they're under stress and whether they're actually needed or not, as opposed or need to be tweaked, as opposed to just accepting what we've accepted over the last 80 years.
I think it's a good point. You know, I think the American people have been quietly having a conversation among themselves about the purpose of American power in the world. And having lived through the first two decades of this century, facing terrorist attacks, facing incomplete wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, dealing with the global financial recession, among other things, many Americans have come away wondering, what kind of world have we built, and will it benefit us as we get deeper into the 21st century? And I think one of the things that has been worrying for the American voter is that very few political leaders have been prepared to address those issues. In fact, I think that President Trump, in his own way, his own eccentric way, has touched on something that has been bothering people for quite a while, which is we don't seem to be winning. Even though, as you say, we have benefited enormously from the structures that we've built over time. And I think in many ways, historians might see the Biden administration as the last gasp of a generational understanding of the world, built during the Cold War and the immediate post-Cold War period, that has run its course, and that it's now up to political leaders in response to the American people to rethink our trajectory of our purpose and power and determine what's next. And I think in this regard, however fearful people might be of the direction President Trump might take, this could actually be a very fecund period of time,
yeah,
with the right kind of political debate and leadership.
Tom, thank you so much for this. I think that we've touched on a number of issues which are front and center and should be on the minds of all Americans as we embark in this very unknown and uncertain period. But, you know, uncertainty and crisis oftentimes brings about change, positive change particularly. And I think that there is a chance to redesign or rethink a lot of the things that we've been doing over the last 80 years, as I've mentioned. And Tom, thank you so much for coming. This has been illuminating in every way. We hope to get you back. We've only touched upon some of these things. We didn't get a chance to talk about Iran and that sort of thing. But thank you so much for your remarks. They are exceedingly thoughtful, and we'll be thinking about them over the next several months.
Definitely. Very refreshing perspective. Thank you very much. Oh, music. Tom, tell us your music idea. It's a good one.
I would go with Johnny Cash's Ain't No Grave Can Hold My Body Down.
All right. I love it. Okay. All right. Well, thank you again.
All right. Thank you, Tom.
American Diplomat is a project of Arizona State University's Leadership, Diplomacy, and National Security Lab, led by senior former diplomatic and national security professionals and providing character-driven leadership, diplomacy, and national security education and training. Thank you also to the American Academy of Diplomacy with support from the American Foreign Service Association, the professional association of the U.S. Foreign Service and home to the award-winning publication The Foreign Service Journal. Visit them online at www.afsa.org. And thank you again to the generous support of the Carnegie Corporation of New York.
There ain't no grave can hold my body down. There ain't no grave can hold my body down. When I hear that trumpet sound, I'm gonna rise right out of the ground. Ain't no grave can hold my body down. Well, look way down the river, and what do you think I see? I see a band of angels, and they're coming after me. Ain't no grave can hold my body down. There ain't no grave can hold my body down. Well, look down yonder, Gabriel. Put your feet on the land and sea. But Gabriel, don't you blow your trumpet till you hear from me. There ain't no grave can hold my body down. Ain't no grave can hold my body down. Meet me, Jesus, meet me. Meet me in the middle of the air. And if these wings don't fail me, I will meet you anywhere. Ain't no grave can hold my body down. There ain't no grave can hold my body down. Well, meet me, mother and father. Meet me down the river road. And mama, you know that I'll be there when I check in, my Lord. Ain't no grave can hold my body down. There ain't no grave can hold my body down. There ain't no grave can hold my body down.